Hi, oh yeah, how are you? Very nice. Good, nice to hear.
It's not very good.
No problem of Kalisha, it's perfect. No, unfortunately.
You did?
I played the violin as a child, but
oh, yeah. That's good. How long did you play violin for?
Around 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
I did.
It wasn't a matter of parents forcing you there.
Well, they did for, I mean, initially.
Yeah,
grew to like it. No, they say they do surveys of adults, and what are people's greatest regrets? That's something. Not playing a musical instrument is one of the regrets people.
Well, I can't play a musical instrument, so.
People really wish they did it.
We're trying. Yeah. You get caught in the rain?
A little bit. Very unusual. This is supposed to be a leap year. This is like 2 months after the end of the rainy season.
Hello. Hi. Is anyone sitting here?
Not for now.
I think the piano makes me sleepy.
Water,
would anyone
like anything else?
Yes, should we fill mine too?
Can you play the
flute, but I don't have it here.
Woo! That side.
Oh, goodness. Is this the last Sunday of the Tzol Pesach, or are you doing
yes.
One more?
Okay. Do you want to put this behind you?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to sit over here.
Not enough room for
an No, over there in the bottom left.
Oh, that's where they. We also have a setup there. Small setups.
She wasn't supposed to be going back to the States forever. Pesach time seems to do this to people.
Yeah.
That I'm not quite understanding that
they they
start with the plan that they're going for Pesach.
And then they never come back.
That's like a week ago she was coming back.
Weird thing over here. Oh, it's in my notebook.
Oh,
look at it.
Oh. Are you gonna kill it?
No, I want to take it off. That's in there.
Kill it. We have too many. They multiply.
Oh God,
we killed it. It's easier if you just do it in like one swoop.
Ugh.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen this video by Mason?
No.
Tell the stories of the prophet.
Oh no.
Really good. You recommend? Yeah. But I also just think he's awesome, so
he is awesome.
I'm biased. No. From the girls.
Oh, thank you. I
see it's just like,
thank you, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. White chocolate is my favorite.
Oh, good.
Don't be fooled, it's not real chocolate.
I know, I'm aware of that. So when did these rabbits show up? I've never seen those rabbits.
Aren't they so cute?
They are. Just.
I saw them, actually, it was one Sunday that happened to align with Easter.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty funny.
Do they come around? They come in, I hear, like, all the time?
I saw them just that one time. Mm. But other girls have seen them, and they have on Easter. But it was super cute. They're quite large.
Yeah, unusual.
It's getting cold, you know?
Is this like truly cold, or like you want it to be cold so much?
Huh? It was psychological.
Which is great.
Leave it out a little bit.
Yeah, Annie!
No cold.
And malas.
And malas.
Yes? The gym was brilliant.
Yeah.
Sweating five times more than normal.
Ooh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Okay, so hello everybody. I don't know if this is it. I was towards the end of the semester. So I know in the boys division too, things are petering out.
The
boys division, right?
Did you move there?
No, not my boys division, which is the non-Hasidic branch of Mayanot. Okay. But anyway, wish you a Chodesh Tov. You know, the month of Nisan, as of course you know, is the month of Geula, the month of redemption, the month of Mashiach. That although Mashiach can come any time, of course, but this is the month that is the most likely time. And therefore, in effect, Yetzias Mitzrayim repeats itself potentially every single year, where Hashem puts into the world the power of redemption, the power of renewal, and therefore it's a very special month. Even before we get to Pesach, it's a very, very special month. Again, I don't know if, I'm assuming, I just want to be sure, you have someone teaching you about the step-by-step of the Seder that
yes,
you have?
Yes, having a boot camp.
Okay, so... So I don't have to repeat that. Okay. So what I want to talk about again, we're really doing some miscellaneous things. Just at this, the last class, we were talking last week about some of the laws regarding telling a non-Jew or asking a non-Jew to do malacha for you. And this is very important. There are a lot of religious Jews, even knowledgeable Jews, who think like there's nothing wrong with that. And you have to understand that there is nothing wrong with the non-Jew working on Shabbos. It's not the non-Jew that is violating anything. The non-Jew that does work for me is not committing a sin. It's not his sin, but it's a sin for me to ask him to do it because the Chachamim prohibited it. Now, it's interesting, the Alter Rebbe in the Shulchan Aruch explains that there are two separate reasons, and you'll see a practical difference. I mean, if a non-Jew doesn't have to keep Shabbos, and that's absolutely the case, and not only that, but you know, a non-Jew is not even supposed to keep Shabbos fully until their conversion. So if a non-Jew is not supposed to keep Shabbos, why can't I ask him, turn on a light, cook for me? So the Alter Rebbe explains there are two separate reasons why you cannot ask a non-Jew to do malacha. And this is a very important analytical structure, because you'll see that it has some practical differences. Reason number one is that on Shabbos, your speech cannot be, in other words, just like you're not allowed to do work, you're not allowed to talk about forbidden malacha on Shabbos.
What about, like, what?
So when I tell a not, in other words, I'm not supposed to say, even about myself, oh, tomorrow I'm planning on traveling to somewhere. Or right after Shabbos, I'm going to build this building or plant my garden. So the Alter Rebbe says, when you tell a goy to do malacha on Shabbos, you're talking about malacha.
What about, like, workers? Like, you know how they have, like, au pairs and things like that living in the house?
Okay, so here, it's very important that you differentiate between malacha and work. Work is a problem too, but I'll talk about that. Malacha is a violation of the 39 categories of labor. Yeah. Now, if I have an au pair, I have a babysitter, and the babysitter is watching my kids, the babysitter is setting the table, or let's say setting the table, that's not one of the 39 malachas.
Yeah, but they do other things as well.
No, okay. In other words, but it's important, let me take it one at a time. It's important that you understand there are going to be two different issues here. One is asking a non-Jew to violate one of the 39 malachos. The other is both non-Jew and Jew to pay them to do stuff on Shabbos, even if it is not one of the 39 malachas. That's a separate issue. And that issue doesn't only apply to a non-Jew, that issue is going to apply to a Jew as well. Obviously, I can't ask a Jew to do one of the 39 malachas, but, you know, you might hire a babysitter, or even a rabbi. A rabbi gets paid, right? We get paid for things we do on Shabbos, or a chazan. And they're going to be problems. So your question is a very excellent question. It's important in your mind that you separate out between what are called molacha problems and what are called employment problems. Right? Those are two different issues. Right now we're going to talk about molacha. Molacha is when I tell a non-Jew or I ask a non-Jew, please, I don't have to command him, even ask him, please turn on a light for me. Generally speaking, can't
do
it.
So you do that whole indirect.
So let's take it one at a time. Again, there's a lot of preliminary material here. So the first reason why it's usher is that the very action of saying turn on a light means you're talking about malachos on Shabbos, and you're not supposed to do that. The second reason is that there is a concept that the goy that's doing it because you asked him is like your shaliach, and therefore, even though the goy is committing no sin, but as your shaliach, it's as if you did it. Now, the Alter Rebbe says, that's not a Torah reason for two reasons. Number one, the law of shlichus, that's, I know you're used to the word shluchim in terms of the particular aspect of outreach and kiruv, but you understand that the word shaliach was not invented by Chabad. The word shaliach is in the Tanakh. And shaliach means literally an agent, or an emissary, or a messenger. And I can make a shaliach for a lot of things. In fact, when you sell your chametz, you make a rabbi a shaliach to sell your chametz. Okay? You can even marry. No, we don't do it today. You can even marry through a shaliach. Now, I don't mean consummate the marriage through a shaliach. That you cannot do. But theoretically, it would be possible. If I'm in one country and my kal is in another country and I can't make the wedding, right? I just can't make it. Gee, you know, whatever it is, American Airlines, you know, didn't make the flight or whatever it will be. So I could actually call up my friends and say, hey, I don't want you to marry my kala, but I want you to be a shaliach, meaning you give
a proxy.
A proxy, right? You give the money on my behalf. Of course, there's always a problem that, you know, there may be a switch. Okay, but the shaliach is supposed... Well, the shaliach may decide to, you know...
To marry
himself. Okay.
All right. That's a good one.
Yeah.
It's good to know who your friends are.
Get, as a matter of fact, is often done through a shaliach to this very day. I've never seen a marriage through a shaliach, although it's in the Gemara. But get is very often. Husbands in America, wives in Israel, or vice versa. And even if they're in the same city, sometimes they don't want to be in the same room. Husband does not want to be there, or wife does not want to be there when husband gives a get. So it's common that under the Beis Din supervision, there will be a proxy, right? So that's Shaliach.
Do you have to sign a contract right there, then be approved?
Well, it's not a big deal, but yes, there has to be a written document that you are making somebody a shaliach. We generally do not, we try not to just do it orally or by telephone call. We want to have more of a
Jewish lawyers.
That's correct. We want to have more of a formality. So the now here's the thing: the Alter Rebbe makes the point that a non-Jew cannot be a shaliach for a Jew. That's a general principle in halacha, and there's also a rule that there's no such thing as being a shaliach for an avera. That if a if I make you a shaliach to desecrate Shabbos and you desecrate Shabbos, it's your sin, it's not my sin. Now, based on that, the concept that when a non-Jew does malacha for me, he's my shaliach and it's my sin, is not true on a Torah level, because number one, he's a goy and he can't be a shaliach, and number two, it's a shaliach for a sinful act. But the Alter Rebbe says that since it looks like shlichut, it looks like he's my emissary, so it is prohibited to have a guy do malacha for me on Shabbos, because it resembles, it looks, it's not, it really is not, but it resembles a concept of shlichut. Now, this is interesting. So we have two different reasons why the rabbis prohibited, it's only rabbinic, the rabbinic law, the rabbis prohibited asking a guy to do malacha on Shabbos. One is because the speech about malacha is not a Shabbostika speech, and two is the non-Jew is acting as my shaliach. Now the Alter Rebbe says, this explains two things. To ask a guy on Shabbos to do malacha on Shabbos for sure is usher, because both reasons apply. I'm speaking about malacha on Shabbos, and he's doing malacha on Shabbos as my shaliach. But consider this: can I ask a goy before Shabbos? Can I tell a goy before Shabbos? Let's say I'm in a hotel, and the hotel has electronic keys, and I'm not allowed to use those keys on Shabbos because it's going to cause lights to turn on and off. I'm not allowed to directly ask a member of the staff to open up the door for me, because that would be asking him to do malacha. So here's my question: if I check in on Friday, can I tell him on Friday, hey, you know, I'm going to be stuck, I'm not going to be able to open the door, be sure to open it for me? So the Alter Rebbe says the first reason, that you're not supposed to talk about malacha on Shabbos, would only apply if you're asking him on Shabbos. But because of the second reason, that when he does it, he's like your shaliach, it is usher. So not only is it usher to ask him on Shabbos to do it on Shabbos, but you can't even ask him on Friday to do it on Shabbos because of shlichus. Now, the other way around, I'll talk about, so what do you do? But now, the other way around, can I ask a guy on Shabbos to do malacha for me after Shabbos?
No, then you have to be careful.
Right, so shlichus is not a problem, because when he's doing it, it's not forbidden, but it's because of speech. So the Alter Rebbe says, very, and again, this is, you know, it's interesting, you know, the Alter Rebbe Shulchan Aruch, or Chabad likes to call it the Shulchan Aruch, is, I guess you need to know this, because obviously, you know, not every aspect of Chabad is totally accepted in every part of the religious world, but the Alter Rebbe Shulchan Aruch is in fact accepted. The Alter Rebbe Shulchan Aruch is a universally acknowledged posek, so this particular bit of analysis is recited in every advanced yeshiva in the world. When we go over the concept of asking to do malacha, these two ideas are always mentioned, and the differences. So this is actually a very, very, this might be perhaps the most well-known psak halacha, or at least explanation of the Alter Rebbe, that we have these two laws. So therefore, as a result, this is called the Isser of Amira La'akum. Akum is just an abbreviation. Oved Kochavim Umazolos. An idol worshiper. A guy, basically. He doesn't have to be an idol worshiper. And so we have three cases. To tell him on Shabbos to do it on Shabbos is usher for two reasons. To tell him on Friday to do it on Shabbos is usher for the reason of shlichus. And to tell him on Shabbos to do it after Shabbos is usher because you're still talking about malacha. Bottom line, therefore, is all three cases are usher. I can't tell him on Friday to do it on Shabbos. I can't tell him on Shabbos to do it on Shabbos. And I can't tell him on Shabbos to do it on Sunday, right? All three cases are usher, although for different reasons. Now again, I want to repeat, this is a rabbinic decree. Now, because it's a rabbinic decree, there are certain leniencies that exist that do not exist under a Torah law. Generally speaking, you cannot violate a Torah prohibition. You cannot cook, you cannot turn on a light unless it is a matter of life and death. Okay? I mean, that's pikuach nefesh. However, amira la'akum, telling a god, is permitted for much, much less than life and death. And let me give you a few examples where amira la'akum may be permitted. Number one, if somebody is seriously ill, even if it's not life-threatening, you can tell a non-Jew to do malacha. Example, somebody has the flu. Let's say somebody has the flu, and they're very sick. And they have a prescription for antibiotics that has to be picked up at a drugstore. Now, their spouse would not be allowed to drive to the drugstore to pick up medicine for a flu, because it depends. I mean, there may be cases, an elderly person, where the flu might in fact be life-threatening. But if a person is of normal health, the flu might be very, very uncomfortable, but it's not a life-threatening situation. So if I have the flu, I can't ask my wife, please drive to the drugstore to pick up medicine. But if I have a non-Jewish neighbor, I don't have to hint. We're not talking about hinting here. I can directly ask the non-Jewish neighbor to drive to the drugstore, assuming the drugstore is too far, and pick up medicine for me. And the reason is because since Amira La'Oved Kochavim is only a rabbinic prohibition, the rabbis did not keep their prohibition in cases of suffering or sickness. I don't mean life-threatening sickness. If that would be the case, even the Torah laws don't apply. But I'm talking about less than life-threatening. Now, there still has to be, it has to be serious and significant. If the person only has a small cold or the like, we would not allow that even for a goy. But something like the flu is a different getter. Okay, that's one example. Now, another example of that, which can come out a lot, maybe this is even a more common example, is, let's say it's the winter, and your heat broke. Either the heat doesn't work or the thermostat was not adjusted properly. So the Gemara says the following. People tend to get sick when it's too cold, right? So as a result, to fix the heat in the middle of the winter or the rainy season is considered to be an attempt to prevent illness, and therefore you can tell a goy to fix the heat. Again, when I'm telling you, you can tell the guy, I don't mean through hinting. No hinting. You tell the guy directly, please fix my heat. And the reason is, the lashon of the Gemara is, and the Shulchan Aruch, hakol cholin eitzel hatsina. Everybody is considered potentially sick when it comes to cold and damp weather. Okay, that. Now, an interesting contemporary question is, does that also apply to air conditioning? In other words, it's clear that if it's the winter and the heat is broken, I can ask a guy to fix it. What if it's the summer and the air conditioning is broken? Now, some people argue, well, it's not the same. Being hot is very uncomfortable, but unless you're on the verge of heat stroke, which is not so common.
Arizona.
It might be. If it's 120 degrees inside, that's one thing. But normally, let's say Yerushalayim, right? Yerushalayim, there was a meteorological study. This is very fascinating. That Yerushalayim has the most perfect climate in the world. I don't know how they figured it out exactly, but they took like the temperatures and the rain and the heat and the cold and the humidity, and they factored it all together, and this is like, on average, this is the best climate in the world. which makes sense. You know, Yerushalayim should have the best climate in the world. So Yerushalayim, I mean, yeah, I mean, sometimes gets uncomfortable, yeah, but it's not like, you know, it's not 120 degrees, and even in terms of compared to Tel Aviv, it's much less humid here, right, than it is in Bnei Brak, Tel Aviv, Rehovot, or whatever it is. So there's a big machlokas. The halacha clearly says, I can ask a guy to repair the heat. Can I ask a guy to repair or turn on, either turn on or repair air conditioning? So that's a machlokas. There are poskim that say symmetrical, the same way you suffer from cold, you suffer from heat. Other poskim say no, cold can make you sick, heat will normally not make you sick. So different poskim. It is better to be strict on that. Okay, so that is overall hetzer number one, that I can tell a guy to do work for me if it is to prevent illness, such as repairing the heating system, or to treat illness, such as getting medicine, or the like. And again, that's not hinting, that is direct. You can just say directly. Same thing, for example, if a woman, let's say, is in the hospital. Let's say the woman is in the hospital for labor, the man is in the hospital for an operation. So a hospital bed commonly has these controls that can be adjusted to make the bed more comfortable, less comfortable, but there are electronic controls. Now, the patient, unless he's dangerously ill, is not allowed to push the button, push the ringer, or push the bell. But assuming that they could get the nurse's attention in some other way, the patient is allowed to ask the nurse, or the doctor, or the orderly, whoever is in the room, to adjust the electric bed to maximize comfort, because since the patient is in the condition of a chola, for a chola we permit amira la'oved kochavim. In fact, ad kidei kach, that one might even debate, could I ask the nurse to turn, again, I'm assuming the nurse is a non-Jew, by the way, a non-Jew, to ask a Jewish nurse, you could not, because you would be causing a Jew to violate Shabbos. When I say ask a nurse, ask an orderly, I'm talking about a non-Jewish nurse or orderly. You might even be able to ask them to turn on the television. Let's say you'd like to watch television on Shabbos. Now, you know, it used to be, when I was growing up, one of the big controversies in Klal Yisrael, now this was before, there were TVs when I was growing up, so I am post-television, but we didn't have VCRs and all sorts of things like that. But so the big question that tore apart the Orthodox world was, could you put your television on a timer so it would turn on Shabbos and you can watch TV, right? So a lot of kids, it's kind of, that's old technology, it's kind of dated, but that's kind of the technology that we were grappling with in those days. And, you know, the bottom line is you should not, because once again, even if you didn't do anything wrong, you just had a Shabbos clock turn on the TV, or even leave it on from, if you want to even be lower tech, just leave it on from before Shabbos. And, you know, but what type of Shabbos ruach? What, you're sitting in your dining room singing Zemiros and, watching Mary Tyler Moore show? What's it's not in the spirit of Shabbos. It's against the holiness of Shabbos. Of course you don't do it. But if you're in a hospital and you're going kind of crazy, so there may be a makom that you could ask the non-Jew to even turn on the TV. Again, hopefully even in the hospital one would find other avenues. But what I'm saying is, Amira Lovichachonim is permitted b'makom chola. Now, chola does not mean a minor thing like a little cold, but chola if you're in a hospital, if you have the flu, if you're bedridden. So Amira Liakum goes out of the window, you're allowed to do that. Now, another important category of Amira Liakum, and this is a little complicated, is this. If you're not asking the guy to do malacha, but the consequence of what you're asking the guy to do will involve malacha, but that's not your intention, you're allowed to ask him. Now, let me give you an example right away, because that sentence was probably a little obscure. The classic example is the refrigerator with a light bulb. Okay, the old problem that people have, that when you open your refrigerator, the light bulb turns on, and you're not allowed to cause lights to turn on Shabbos. So that's why every Orthodox person knows that you have to unscrew the light bulb.
Or put tape or something,
either your light bulb or tape the thing that goes in and out, to be sure that it does not turn on when Shabbos comes in. Now let's say you realize Friday night that you forgot to tape the door or unscrew the light bulb. So if I open up the refrigerator, the light's going to turn on. So what do? I can't get my food. So here is the principle. Now this is not going to work in all cases, but because you're not always going to have a guy. But if I have a non-Jewish neighbor, and again, this is not hinting, this is asking. I can ask the non-Jewish neighbor, can you please open up the refrigerator for me? Because I'm not allowed to do it. Mm-hmm. Now, you may ask, why is that permitted? I'm asking him to effectively turn on a light. I couldn't ask a guy, please turn on my kitchen lights. The answer is, because you're not really directly asking him to turn on a light. In fact, you don't care if the light goes on or off. All you care about is that the refrigerator door be open in order that you get the food. It is only a consequence, meaning it is not your direct desire that the light goes on. The light is a consequence of an otherwise permissible activity, because opening the door is intrinsically permissible. So in a case like this, you can't open the door because you know the light will turn on, but there is no issur of asking a guy to open the door because it is not your intention that the light turn on. So lemaisa, the guy can open the door, and you can even ask the guy to close the door. Now what's interesting is this. Your concern might be, well, gee, once the guy opened the door, can I ask the guy to unscrew the light bulb? Because that will allow me to. So there you got a problem, you see, because when I ask the guy to unscrew the light bulb, or I ask the guy to push in the button, I am asking him directly to extinguish the light. So there may not be mutter. So when you got that guy, just get all your food out right then, because you will not be allowed to ask the guy. Now, if the guy on his own, now this is where hinting comes in. I cannot ask the guy, please unscrew the light bulb. I can ask him, please open the refrigerator. No hinting for that. Just open the refrigerator.
You could say the reason why
right.
I can't.
Right. That's correct.
The light bulb
now, I'm not allowed to ask him to unscrew the light bulb or put out the light by pushing in the button and taping it, because that's a direct request to do malacha. But this is where hinting comes in. And the way the hinting would work is you explain your predicament, and then you hope he's a bright enough fellow that he will figure out what he's supposed to do. And you say, you know, the reason why I asked you to do this is because the light goes on and I'm not allowed to cause a light to go on or off. So the guy might say to you, so what do you want me to do? Would you like me to unscrew the light? You cannot say yes.
You can
do what you'd like to do. I can't tell you. Well, again, sometimes a person not familiar with the laws of Shabbos is not really going to get your drift. It's not really going to know.
That's a great idea.
No. That's too much.
You said it.
So what the poskim say is, I mean, you kind of sound like a broken record. Just repeat, when the guy says, do you want me to unscrew the light? You say, I cannot unscrew the light. You know, I cannot unscrew the light. Now,
and they slowly back out.
Right. Right. Well, I tell you.
The mistake was so weird.
Yeah. Well, the truth of the matter, is, you know, if it's a guy that lives in a Shomer Shabbos neighborhood, it's not so weird. He gets used to it, you know. In fact, the justice who just died on the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia, Scalia was very fond of Orthodox Jews. He used to speak, in fact, a really classic joke. He came to a Jewish convention, and he said how much he loves being in a Jewish convention. He apologized, though. He says he hasn't been able to keep up with the Daf Yomi because of his job. That's when you learn a page of Gemara.
Why would
he? It was a joke. But anyway. But Scalia was a Shabbos guy, meaning to say in the Hyde Park, that's the University of Chicago area, that's where he was a law professor. He says he was utilized by many Orthodox Jews to help them with Malacha on Shabbos and the like. So if the guy is used to it, he'll take the hint. But do you see the idea?
Gemara, then you're fine.
Yeah, right. Did you want to say? Yeah.
I was wondering, can you do that with like anything? Like even if your stove is on, for example, you can hint.
No. So this is tricky. There are three categories here. Sometimes you can actually ask directly, such as for a sick person and the like, or when it's an indirect thing that you're asking him to open the door and the like is just an indirect consequence. Sometimes you're not allowed to ask directly, but you're allowed to hint. One example would be, I could hint to him to unscrew the bulb or push in the button and the light. I can hint. I can also say, for example, if I'll give you a third example, if there's a light in my bedroom and I can't go to sleep, I am not allowed to ask him to turn off the light, but I can hint. I can just say, wow, you know, I can't really sleep when the light is on and I'm not allowed to turn off the light.
Oh my God, you cannot.
Yeah, now, there are, now this is...
You turn off the light, say you left the light on the bar and you really couldn't sleep.
Yes.
With the light.
Yeah, you can say, yeah,
can you turn it off yourself?
Absolutely not. No. I hope you're not confused about that. No, you cannot. I know it's very hard. It's happened to me too. So you either get a mask, you know, cover your eyes, you know, whatever it would be. Or some people can sleep with the light. I don't know. I can't, but some people can sleep with the light on. But absolutely, you know, it's not. You cannot turn off the light yourself. But you can't ask the guy to do it either. But you can hint to the guy.
If you turned up in a non-Jewish person's house, okay, in your pajamas in the middle of the night, okay, if they weren't freaked out by that bit, and then you ask them to go back to yours, oh, don't worry, I'll show you when I get there, because you can't obviously explain to them. Like, at what? Oh,
no, they, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, it is. It is hard. Now, there is a third category, though. This is where a lot of people make a mistake, because people think you can always hint. You can always hint. Not true. You cannot hint to a guy if you are going to get direct benefit from what he's doing. So I can't hint to. Let's say, for example, my stove is on the blink, and I want to hint to the guy to fix my stove so I can have hot cholent. Or the opposite, the room is dark and I want to hint to the guy to turn on the light by telling him I can't read in the dark. Not allowed to do that. Now, there's a very subtle distinction, meaning, let's take this very simple case. I can hint to the guy to turn off a light. I cannot hint to a guy to turn on a light.
Is this about increasing the heat?
Or increasing the benefit. The difference is that one is the removal of a suffering, and the other is giving you a positive benefit.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Okay?
Both indirectly. So you remove the pain of you can't see, but you benefit the fact that you're getting...
Yeah, I understand. But we look at it this way. In fact, that's the hetzer. Let's go back to a hotel now. See, now you understand some of the subtleties here. I'm in a hotel. The hotel has an electronic lock. I'm not allowed to use that on Shabbos, let's assume, although it's not so simple, why not? Because whatever it is, when I push it in, I get a green light. When I take it out, I get a red light. So you're causing circuits to be closed, lights to be generated. The principle basically is, I mean, we need to explain that principle too, that turning on and off lights is a form of fire and extinguishing of fire. Okay, that needs actually more development, but let's go with that assumption. So I'm not allowed to use that key, okay? Now, can I directly ask somebody of the hotel staff, assuming they're non-Jewish, please put in the key?
Yes.
No, I cannot.
No.
No, I cannot, because I'm asking a non-Jew to do malacha for me.
Right.
Okay, but here is the question. So now, can I hint to him, meaning to say, can I go over to him and say, you know, I'm not allowed to use an electronic key on Shabbos because the lights go in and out, on and off. So I cannot go into my room. And the non-Jew then says, do you want me to open the door? And you have to get, once again, give that crazy answer. You do what you want, but I can't go in without assistance. So at that point, you're allowed to do that. Now, why are you allowed to do that? Because the principle is this. Letting you into your room is not giving you a benefit. He is simply taking away the blockage, meaning it's similar to turning off the light, meaning your room is there waiting for you. There is a negative force that's preventing you from entering. It is a very subtle distinction. It's not a simple distinction. But the basic idea, therefore, is, bottom line, practically, is that you can hint to the person to let you come in, but for things like turning on lights, you cannot. And not only that, let me go a little further. Not only can I not hint if a guy turns on my lights or whatever it is, but even if he did it on his own for me, I'm not allowed to benefit from what he did. That actually means, if a non-Jew turned on a light in the room, and I would benefit from it, I am not allowed to read in that room.
Yes.
If.
So what about a TV? If someone switches TV on, you won't be able to watch it.
That's exactly correct.
It's just for you.
Now, let me explain the difference. If the guy did it because he also wants to watch TV, then you're allowed to watch it with him. But if he only did it for you and he's leaving.
What if he initially sat with you? And then he left.
Well, that's okay, because as long as he sat there for a minute, he doesn't have to sit there for the whole show. So same thing with hot water. If a guy, this is a problem in hotels actually, if a guy heated up water for the Jewish patrons of a hotel, even if they didn't ask him, a Jew is not allowed to drink that water on Shabbos. But if there's even one non-Jewish guest,
it's like, hey, come try this water.
Or one of the waiters themselves.
Come forth.
And drink from that water.
Then
you're not allowed to ask him to do it, but you're allowed to drink the water. Right?
So, are you allowed to ask him to drink the water with you?
Well, let me put it this way. When you see him about to heat up the water, you can say like this. You don't ask him to heat up the water, but say, I really hope that you'll have a drink with us. And then he'll say, wow, that's really gracious. You're offering me a glass of water.
Okay.
It's not like a glass of scotch or something. But
it really interests, because if you're like on a cruise,
yeah,
and you're with your family who don't keep Shabbat,
yeah,
can you rely that they're going to open the door with the card key? Or you can't rely on that.
They're Jewish.
I know, because
they walk in before.
Yeah. So well, once they open it, you can go in. You cannot ask it. In other words, you cannot. That's right. You cannot use your parents like Shabbos guy. I mean, you can't say, "Hey, mom, dad, you don't keep Shabbos anyway, so you know." turn on the lights for me.
If they turned it on, can you benefit? Because there are two who's violating.
If a Jew violates the Shabbos, then you're not allowed to benefit from that activity on Shabbos.
At all.
So I have a question. If
they turned on a light,
you cannot read by that light.
What if they opened the door?
Now it's a little. Let me just explain something. It's a little complicated because if there's enough natural light that you would be able to read, even though the light makes it better, you are allowed to.
But if it's at night?
If it's at night, you cannot read in that room.
What if they just walk up and say, oh, you can't read in the dark, turn on the light and walk away, and you're just like...
Well, this may sound crazy, but you got to close your book.
Can you open it again after that?
No, I mean, in other words, you cannot benefit.
What about, yeah. I go to my cousin's house, and like, I can't leave lights on at their house, they don't like it, but when I'm there, they know that they'll turn lights on for me, because they want them on and off. So like, if I were living, staying by myself, I would leave them on, but they go around, turn them off, and then they come around, and they turn them back on. Like,
yeah. Well, it's
a hard. They would shout at me as well.
It's a hard. It's a hard.
And they're not Jews.
He's paying that bill. That's all we're going.
Yeah. Oh, they're not Jews.
They're not Jews.
Well, the halacha is pretty strict here. The halacha basically says you're not supposed to benefit even from what a non-Jew did if they did it for you. Now, I would say there may be a difference between common rooms and your private bedroom, meaning to say, if they turn a light on in a dining room, in a living room, so they're also doing it for themselves, so you can benefit from it. But if they did it in a private area that they don't go into, that's only your area, then you have a problem. You're not supposed to benefit from it.
Like when I go, my cousin and I share a room. So like she might be walking past, realize I'm going into the room in the dark, and she'll be like, oh, she turned the bedroom light off, so she'll flick it on, and like she'll go do something else, and then she might come back into the room in 2 minutes and like hang out with me. So she is benefiting, but not right away.
I think that's sufficient. In other words, even if the motive is for you, but if she's also going to be hanging around and doing stuff, okay, even if it's not for that minute, that would be fine.
If they turned on the light in Rupert's case, right, and then she's going to benefit to read the book, so she's not allowed to read the book, so she's sitting there with her book closed, and they come in and they open the book, and the minute they open a book to read, it's okay for her to sit and read?
Yes, it is.
Oh, for goodness sake.
You just hand the book and say, read?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, so can you get them to turn off still? So say it's like on Shabbos and you want like your stove off.
You can hint to them to turn off the stove. Hints, not ask. That's correct.
What if they've like been so many times they come now?
Okay, then you don't have to hint. Then it's fine. Yeah. That's fine. Okay. So again, there are a lot of details here, but I just want you to get the basic idea. Now remember, I said at the beginning that we have to divide this into malacha problems versus employment problems. Mm-hmm. I'll talk about employment in a moment, but right now I just want you to know the basic parameters of having non-Jews do work for you, malacha for you on Shabbos, and it is a very, very serious law that people, you know, all the questions you're asking are really good, because even very religious people, don't know these laws and don't follow these laws. These are, I mean, I hate to tell you stuff that makes your life harder. I don't like to do that. But what can I do? Well, Rabbi Kaufman enjoys it.
That he comes to class to make our lives
different. Okay, all right. I hear. But nevertheless, these are at least general halachas that you should be aware of. Yes, you want to say?
Thanks. If we're forbidden to speak of malachos on Shabbos,
except to learn, you can learn the laws of malachos.
Yeah. So it's like.
No, you don't speak about things you're going to do, right? Yeah, you're not
practically.
Right.
It's like you
yes.
Talk about work.
Thank you.
Right, you don't say that after Shabbos I'm going to do this and do that and do that and do that.
Can you
know?
Teach someone about your business?
Not really. Not on Shabbos. Not on Shabbos. You know, one of the laws of Shabbos is the things you talk about on Shabbos, not just the things you do. Yeah.
What if like, often there's like big Shabbos tables, and like you go around and you say like where you're from, like what you do with your life. And so like, are you allowed to mention like where you work?
You know, it's
like what's that, and then you have to explain what you do.
You know, it's very interesting that. A strict, very machmir view of halacha would say you're not allowed to, but the universal minhag is that we are lenient. We do allow you to briefly describe what you're doing, as long as you don't get into detail. Otherwise, you'd have to be like those people, you know, those people who are spies, you know, they say, if I would tell you what I do, I'd have to kill you, you know, so you can't.
I'm going to use that from now on.
Right. Okay. Alrighty. Now, let's talk about the other branch of it, and that is. Let's say that you're not having a non-Jew do malacha for you. Okay? You're not right? But you have either a Jew or a non-Jew that does things that are not malacha, but they're doing services for you on Shabbos. It might be a babysitter, it might be a Jewish babysitter. Maybe a rabbi that gets paid by a synagogue, maybe a cantor, maybe a chazan, etc. It may be somebody who, a cleaning lady. Now again, the cleaning lady cannot operate a vacuum cleaner or the like on Shabbos, that's for sure. But what if she's making beds? What if she's just dusting, doing? What if she's doing things?
Fluffing up my pillows for me.
Right. That's right. Well, if you're from South Africa, you probably have someone like that. Everybody there has a slave. Kind of, you know. No, I saw this myself. I was in Johannesburg. No, I use the word slave deliberately because they kind of really is. There really is kind of that unfortunate, old-fashioned relationship.
Wow.
They get paid.
Oh yeah, yeah. It is different. They do get paid. But you know, it's a funny thing. On one hand, people live. It's Baruch Hashem. It's a wealthy community, and they live in gigantic houses. But they're like armed camps because the street is so dangerous. The crime is so great that people live behind guard houses and they have guards and dogs. And if they have to walk two blocks to shul, you know, they go like almost an armored truck, you know, to not on Shabbos, but whatever. They would go with a lot of people to shul. So it's very, very amazing in that way. Okay, so the question I now want to talk about is employment on Shabbos. So here we have a very, very interesting rule. And this is a rule on the recipient, not on the giver. And that is, a Jewish person is not supposed to get paid, even after Shabbos, for things they did on Shabbos. Okay. Now, let me explain. It's not usher for me to pay somebody. In other words, if I have a non-Jew who did non-malacha, like making beds or babysitting, I can pay the non-Jew, that's for sure. The problem is the recipient. If I'm a Jewish person, I am not supposed to get paid. Now, there'll be many exceptions, obviously, but beware of this law. I am not supposed to get paid, this is a rabbinic law, for things I did on Shabbos. So that would mean standing alone, a Shabbos babysitter cannot get, standing alone, obviously, cannot get paid for babysitting on Shabbos. A rabbi cannot get paid, per se, for giving a drasha on Shabbos, and the like. So this is a rabbinic prohibition that is called Sechar Shabbos. Sechar Shabbos just means payment for Shabbos.
What if you're a madrasa for like a Shabbos one?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same problem. Now, I'll explain in a moment. So how do you get paid? Yep. All right. So,
cheeky Jews, I tell you.
You're
going to
do it just
after
Shabbos, and they're going to be like, I'm going to give you 500 shekels.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In order to get paid, for what you do on Shabbos, it has to be combined, even in a small degree, in a lump sum, for a total package in which you did stuff either before Shabbos or after Shabbos. So for example, let's say I'm a Torah reader in a shul, right? So I get paid every week, let's say I get paid 200 shekel for reading the Torah. I cannot just get paid for reading the Torah, so basically the contract has to say, it's a formality, that we are paying you for the time that you prepare before Shabbos, together with your reading on Shabbos, and therefore we're giving you a lump sum for your non-Shabbos and Shabbos activity. Now, in the case of a Torah reader or a rabbi, that's fairly simple, because obviously what the rabbi or the Torah reader does involves pre-Shabbos preparation, such as preparing the Torah reading or preparing the sermon.
Can you pay a non-Jew for what they did on Shabbos?
Nope, same problem. Even with the non-Jew, in other words, because... Oh, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. Yes. The problem is the recipient, not the giver. Okay. That's right.
As long as it's non-malacha.
That's right. Now, in the case of the rabbi, in the case of the Torah reader, this is called havla'ah. Havla'ah means swallowed up. The Shabbos job is swallowed up in the non-Shabbos job. Okay, it's like... By the way, we have a similar, perhaps, legal evasion about Shemitah. It's a totally different problem, but you'll see the same similar idea. You know, the halacha is that any fruit that grows during Shemitah is holy and cannot be sold commercially. You cannot commercially sell Shemitah fruit. Now, that created a problem this past Sukkos because the Esrogin of Eretz Yisrael had grown during Shemitah. Mm-hmm. So how could they charge you for an esrog?
They were planted before.
Well, they weren't planted before. It's not because it doesn't depend on the tree. It depends on the fruit of every year.
Right.
So the answer is that when you buy a Shemitah esrog, you're not paying for the esrog, you're paying for the lulav. and the S-Rogue is just thrown in for free. Now, that's a very strange thing. I'll tell you why. Because normally an S-Rogue is very expensive, and the Lulav and the Hadassim are very cheap. But after Shemitah, they make it the opposite. Oh, we're not charging you for the S-Rogue, but we're charging you $200 for the Lulav, and then the Esra goes in for free. So if you say, but I just, so just give me the Esra. No.
I said there's a problem with that, because like supermarkets, for example, can't make an offer on something like that. Like, they can't say, oh, now £17 before £9.99, when it was never £9.99.
Yeah, I understand. Esra stores are not subject to the laws of supermarkets and the like. Okay? This is called Tavla. So what do you do in the case of a babysitter? It's not so simple. Now, Madricha, I think you'd be able to fix, the Madricha does stuff before Shabbos, does stuff after Shabbos. The babysitter would have to do something. She'd have to either hang around till after Shabbos, or even if she comes, 5 minutes before lich benching. That's good. But if she is a Saturday morning to Saturday afternoon babysitter, there's a real shaila. How does she get paid? Right? How does she get paid? It's not a simple thing. This is called Sechar Shabbos. And there's going to be a problem, and the like, right? So one needs to be aware of this. And again, as I said, and as you said, this is not a problem with a non-Jewish worker, because Sechar Shabbos is about the recipients, not the giver. So I, as a Jew, can pay a non-Jew for non-malacha work they did on Shabbos, but I, as a Jew, am not allowed to receive that work for Shabbos. In fact, this is actually an issue. I'll tell you where this comes up a lot. If I'm not allowed to get paid for Shabbos activity, so consider this. I don't know if any of you are into web pages or web design or the like. Let's talk about low tech first, then I'll talk about internet. What about a vending machine? Let's say I own a vending machine, right? And the vending machine has soda and potato chips and chocolate, and people put in money and they get the food. Mm-hmm. Am I allowed to keep my vending machine open on Shabbos? No, to allow people, let's say in the airport, in the bus station. Now listen, if my vending machine is in Mea Shearim, in all likelihood it's not going to be used on Shabbos. But let's say my vending machine is in a place where there's a lot of non-religious Jews or non-Jews who are going to put money in it. So in effect, I'm getting money for Shabbos activity. Now, there are a few different problems here. If you had to analyze, this is simple, this is low tech. We're not talking about vending machines that have been around for, 100 years, more than 100 years. What would the halachic problem be with the vending machine? So there's actually two problems. Let me explain two problems. Problem number one is that if Jews are going to use the machine, are you causing Jews to violate Shabbos?
Not if there's something else around.
If they're in the airport, well, you're for sure not.
Well, no, but here's my question. When they use a vending machine, they're mechalel Shabbos. Number one, they're handling money. Number two, they're pushing buttons that have electronic circuitry and lights.
So you're just causing more violations.
So that's the question. Am I allowed to cause a Jew that already violates Shabbos to do more Shabbos violations?
No, you're actually going to be...
So the truth is, you normally can't, just because they're doing 100 Averas.
It's not a necessary action for them.
Because they could choose not to use the machine.
Right, it's not like...
And yeah. It's not like forcing them to...
Okay. So that's a good question. Meaning to say, the argument is, I'm not giving them non-kosher food. I have an opportunity. Nobody's telling them to use it. And you're also right, if there's other vending machines besides mine, they could go to the other vending machine, etc. Okay, but that is an issue. Some say that you don't want to encourage even if someone's mechalel Shabbos by being in the airport and by driving and by taking a plane and by doing everything, you don't want to be the cause of an extra sin. Okay. But there's another issue. And that is, okay, even if non-Jews use it, or even if the non-religious Jew is Mechalel Shabbos anyway, but you're getting profit from Shabbos activity, is it not Sechar Shabbos? And you can't even use the Svara, the argument, that the payment is a mix, because it may be true that the money is mixed, but the discrete Shabbos purchase is money for the Shabbos purchase. It's not like paying the babysitter for services that were done before. So here, there is
But what if you, like, let's say, put in the stuff just before Shabbat came in, and therefore the things they're purchasing are the things that you arranged for before? So, like...
No, but so what? You're still getting paid
because
of a Shabbos purchase.
No.
In other words...
Because with the Madrichah thing, you said, like, as long as they, you know, do something in advance to prepare for it, then it's okay.
No, but the difference is, well, okay, that's only logical in an employment contract. As an employer, I can say, I'm paying you for your work before Shabbos. But when I put money in a vending machine, I'm not paying you for what you did. I'm not paying you for your labor. I'm paying
you for... essentially. You're paying for something that you had, like, it had to be there before they paid for it. They didn't put it in, and then, oh, okay, here we go, in exchange for the money that you gave me.
Yeah, but you're paying for what you're getting on Shabbos. You can't really say...
But it's something that was there before.
It was put there before. Yeah, well, okay, so actually, the truth of the matter is that the bottom line is the poskim do permit it, and they use somewhat of your reasoning, and they basically say that the issur of Schar Shabbos is to pay somebody for labor that they did on Shabbos. Mm-hmm. Here, they're buying a product. Now, they could have bought the product before Shabbos. They could, in other words, the product was in the machine before Shabbos, and therefore, there is no connection between Shabbos and the money. The money is for a product, for a thing. Now, let's apply this to an analogous problem. Let's say you have a website, and the website sells things, right? You sell stuff. You might sell whatever you sell. You might sell books, you might sell jewelry, you might sell clothing. Let's say you're a mini Amazon. Do I have to close my website on Shabbos?
No.
Or am I allowed to have people submit orders?
Couldn't you wait to accept payment until after Shabbos?
So one possibility is that you can actually allow the submission of orders, but the credit cards are not processed, so you're not getting payment.
But that itself wouldn't
totally answer, because the issue of Schar Shabbos is you're not supposed to get paid for Shabbos activity, even if you're getting paid after Shabbos. So that wouldn't be an automatic answer. But still, the post can say...
It's a bit weird, because who's Shabbat time in Shabbos?
That's another question. I'll get to that. That's another question. That is a very good question. But putting that aside, the post can basically treat an internet website as analogous to a vending machine. And they actually do permit it to be open on Shabbos, as long as the actual credit card processing is delayed. So that's the analogy. Now, it is brought down, however, that if your website is a website that caters exclusively to Jews, so for example, let's say your website sells Jewish religious objects. Now, some going might buy them, but you know, you're not just doing clothing or general books. But right, you sell mezuzahs, you sell kesuvos, etc. So the poskim say that if your website caters exclusively to Jews, it is better to close it down for Shabbos. Now then we have your question, which is very excellent. Well, wait a second here.
Yeah, Chabad.org doesn't shut down for Shabbos.
Well, okay. The question becomes, if a website has to close down for Shabbos, whose Shabbos does it close down for?
You're right.
Because a website, there's worldwide access. People in Australia and you know, Shabbos is in the world around 48 hours. Meaning somewhere in the world,
it's always Shabbos.
For 48 hours, it's Shabbos. Almost 48 hours. So does that mean a website has to shut down for...
ever?
Well, it'll be two days a week, you know, and the like. So... Art Scroll, you know the Art Scroll people, they actually shut down their website on Shabbos, but only the Shabbos of New York where they're located. Now I have to admit that does not make a lot of conceptual sense. I mean, you can either say, hey, we're not responsible, our website is open, we're not telling anybody to use it, or you can say we're not going to cause a Jew to desecrate Shabbos. But if you take the position we're not going to cause you to desecrate Shabbos, then you got to worry about Shabbos everywhere, because people from Australia, you know, order Art Scroll books as well. Now, why does Chabad keep their website open on Shabbos?
To be accessible to everyone.
So here's the thing: the Chabad website obviously does not sell things. I don't think, right? They sell anything in Chabad website? No. So this is but this is primarily a learning website, and Chabad's Cheshbon comes into an analogous question of what are you allowed to have a Jew do to encourage them to become more Jewish? Now, this leads to another question. See, every question leads to another question. That is, can I invite somebody to a Shabbaton or to my house for Shabbos if I know they're going to drive? Now, this is a complicated question. I can't address all of the ramifications, but here's the question. On one hand, I'm causing them to violate Shabbos by driving. On the other hand, if I wouldn't invite them, it's likely that perhaps they would do more violations of Shabbos at home. And moreover, even if they're violating Shabbos now, but by giving them that connection to Shabbos, I might be able to eventually develop a relationship that will bring them to keep Shabbos in the future and other commandments. Masha'en Kain, if I never invite them for Shabbos, they'll never have that experience, right? So that's the question. So Lamaisa, we do Paskin, and certainly Chabad absolutely Paskins this way, but even non-Chabad, that in a situation where somebody violates Shabbos anyway, and there's at least a good chance that by their experience of Shabbos over time, I mean, I don't mean right away, but over time, there's a good chance that they would come to love Shabbos and keep more mitzvos. You are allowed to invite them, provided that you give them the option of a place to stay. In other words, you have to have a place for them. You have to tell them you would like it much more if they would come for the whole 24 hours. And if they then turn down the opportunity, you do not withdraw. You know, you don't withdraw the invitation. You say, you know, you're welcome any time. So based on that conceptual framework, that is kind of why Chabad has its website open. Because if you think about it, it's exactly the same type of problem. That maybe somebody who doesn't keep Shabbos will read something on the website. In other words, the same idea that you invite them because even if in the short term there are averos, in the long term it may yield positive benefit. So that would be the svara. But that's more of a svara, more of a reason for informational websites. It's not. It's less so for commercial websites. You don't have to sell your mezuzahs, you know, on Shabbos and the like. Yeah.
Wait, so can you ask a non? Sorry, select this. But can you ask the non-Jew, ask them if they like wash the dishes? If there's a way, and I know that they can use hot water because they choose to,
yep.
But could they theoretically run the dishwasher also if you didn't ask them?
Okay, so here, the problem with these areas of halacha is that there are so many different areas that impact on a single situation. That is, you are correct. I can ask a non-Jew to do something for me if there's any way they could do it permissibly, even if they choose to do it impermissibly. So I can ask a non-Jew to wash dishes because they could wash dishes in cold water or the like. So if they decide to use hot water because it's easier for them, that's okay. Now, so the question you're asking is, if that's true, why can't they run the dishwasher? Right? Because I didn't ask them to use the dishwasher. That's for their convenience. You're right. Based on the logic of this law, it should be okay. But there's another law of Shabbos that you're not allowed to operate electric appliances that make a lot of noise. So it depends. If it's a quiet dishwasher, maybe it'll be mucher. But things that make a lot of noise are a maris ayin. People hear your dishwasher going and they're going to think that... That's why you don't have a guy use a washing machine. That's why there's no vacuum cleaner. In fact, that's even the problem with the TV on Shabbos, even on a timer, actually. It may be that problem. This is called Mashmia Kol, and that's a totally separate law of Shabbos. There's even a discussion about are you allowed to have an alarm clock wake you up on Shabbos, since it makes noise.
Shabbos alarm?
even a Shabbos alarm, because the actual action of making noise is something.
You can watch TV, like even Hanan, you want to watch TV.
According to that reasoning, TV would be forbidden even if a non-Jew is watching it for himself.
Subtitles are okay.
Yeah, subtitles are okay. Silent movies are okay. Yeah. Right. Right.
Well, the Shabbos channel.
The Shabbos channel, right. Right. Yeah. So that's kind of a separate principle of called mashmiya call.
So okay. If you ask them to set the table.
Yep.
I see people this all the time, but I don't think it's allowed by that.
Yeah.
You can't ask someone to cut, like, you know those plastic cable cloths?
Yes.
Like, they can't do that. You can't ask them.
That's correct. That's correct. You
but
cannot.
You can just say set the table, and then they would have to.
But if they do it, correct. You benefit.
Well, there you do have a problem, because you're not allowed to benefit from what they do either. Meaning to say, you get into this subtle heter, meaning if they simply get rid of dirt, that's called taking away something bad. You see, that's not called benefiting. But if they cut the tablecloths, they're giving you a new positive.
You can set the table, though, and then if they chose to do that? Or
no, because then you'd have the problem of benefiting.
Unless they were sitting with you, right? So they
unless they did it for themselves, too. That's right. So this is going to be, in other words, this is going to be a real, real subtlety. As when are you getting benefit, and when are they just removing something negative? That's a very, very tricky question. That's a very important question in the laws of Shabbos. Okay, so this is something to be aware of. Let me just mention one other little thing, and this may be relevant to the refrigerator. We know, of course, you're not allowed to turn on a light or turn off a light or any electrical appliance on Shabbos. So here is the issue. Let's say you have a Shabbos clock. And let's talk about adjusting a Shabbos clock for a moment. And your lights are going to go off at 11 p.m. And you have a longer meal than you thought. Mm. And it's a quarter to 11, and you're just in the main course or whatever it is, and the like, and you're probably going to go until 12:30. So you don't want the lights to go off. Are you allowed to turn the dial of the Shabbos clock, right? Let's assume it's a dial Shabbos clock, a simple turning of the dial, right? You push, turn it off. Can I turn the dial so the lights will stay on for another hour?
No.
So here we have a very, very big machlokas, a big, big machlokas. According to Rav Moshe Feinstein, you are absolutely not allowed to do an action on Shabbos that keeps the lights on longer than they otherwise would be, because that's tantamount to turning on a light by keeping it on longer. By the same token, you certainly would not be allowed to cause it to go off earlier. Let's say the other way around, that the light in my room is going to go off at 12 midnight, but I'm ready to go to bed at 11. I'm not allowed to turn the clock backwards, because that would be putting it off earlier. Even if it doesn't go off right away, even if it's a quarter to 11, I want it to go off at 11. But we have an interesting counterpsak from Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach has a very interesting ruling. He says, if all you're doing by your action is maintaining the existing situation, that is not called doing malacha. So he says the following: if the lights are on, you are permitted to continue them in that condition by turning the Shabbos clock later, but you could not turn the Shabbos clock to go off earlier. Vice versa, if the lights are off, you cannot turn the clock to go on earlier, but you can, if you want to keep it off, you can turn the clock to go off later. Because his idea is, you're not allowed to cause lights to turn on or turn off, but you're allowed to extend the existing condition that they are in. Do you see the logic of that? So that's about Shabbos clock. The only thing is, he says the following little limitation. Since Shabbos clocks are muktzah on Shabbos, and you're not allowed to handle them, so any adjustments has to be made with a shinoi in an unusual way. So you use your knuckle, you know, you use your fingers or whatever it is. You can't just turn it in the regular way. So this is a big machlokas. According to Moshe Feinstein, you do not adjust Shabbos clocks at all. According to Shlomo Zalman, you have to be very careful that you're doing it right. You are allowed to extend the status quo, but you cannot cause the status quo to be changed earlier. So if it's on, you can't cause it to go off earlier. If it's off, you cannot cause it to go on earlier. But you can cause, when it's off, you can cause it to stay off for longer. When it's on, you can cause it to stay on for longer and go off later. Now, the same principle applies, if you think about this, to a thermostat. Now, let me point out, a lot of thermostats today are digital readouts, so you absolutely cannot... In other words, when I change a thermostat, there's going to be a digital readout, absolutely forbidden. Okay, I'm not talking about... In fact, maybe the whole thing is theoretical today, because I think virtually every thermostat is a digital thermostat. But let's go back... Do you have an old-fashioned one? Yeah, but let's go back to the old-fashioned ones of your parents or your house, and that is... The thermostats are, you know, you just move a switch at a temperature, but there's no digital picture that you get. So here is the same thing. Let's think about this. Let's say I have an air conditioner, and the air conditioner is going to go, right now the air conditioner is off. And the air conditioner is programmed to go on when the temperature is 75. Right now it's 72. And let's say I'm still cold in the house. I'm cold. This might be I'm cold. I don't want... I mean, this would never happen to me, but theoretically. So let's say I want to move the thermostat from 75 to 80 so that the air conditioner will not kick in till the temperature is 80. Now, if right now it's set to be activated at 75... and the temperature is 72. So right now it's off. So by pushing it to 80, I'm going to keep it off for longer. That would be permitted because I'm simply prolonging the existing condition. You see? But if it's set to be activated at 75, and I'd like it to be activated at 72, I'm not allowed to do that because I would be causing it to go on earlier. That's for air conditioning. Now, the same thing. Let's say the air conditioning is on, but because the thermostat is set to 80, so let's say it's 85 in the house, so when it hits 80, it's going to shut off, but I want it to stay on longer. So while the air conditioner is working, I want to lower the thermostat, which will have the effect, right, are you following? It'll have the effect of keeping the air conditioning on for a longer time. I'd be allowed to do that. If, however, it's going to go off at 80, and I want it to go off at 82, I'm not allowed to do that because I went, right? So this is Rav Orbach's Chiddush. So again, Rav Moshe says no adjustments are allowed. Rav Orbach says any adjustment that prolongs the condition that it is in is permitted as long as you're not accelerating a change. Okay, so that's really, and so that applies in two contexts. That applies to thermostats, and that applies, I mentioned two cases. One was thermostats, and one was the... Shabbos timers. Yeah, timers and thermostats. Okay, so that's a big, big machlokas that you need to know. But remember, even like Rav Orbach, thermostats and timers are muktza, so they have to be moved with a shinoi. Okay? Alrighty. I think that's what I had for tonight. I had I have two other topics, but I would need more than an hour for them. The two other topics I wanted to talk about, we'll get to, is I wanted to talk about Well, I'll mention one halacha that you need to know. You know, that one of the mitzvahs that, again, sometimes even very religious people don't even keep, is the mitzvah called Tevilas Kelim, right? Being Tevel, right? This is an important halacha. This is a Torah commandment. This is not a rabbinic commandment. And that is that utensils that you use in the preparation or serving of food that are made of metal or glass, not plastic and not wood, have to be immersed in a mikveh before you can use them for eating or cooking or storage of food. Now, this only applies if you bought them from a non-Jew, or they were made by a non-Jewish factory and the like. And this is called Tevilas Kelim. Again, it only applies to metal, glass, and ceramic glazed china is a suffix, because on one hand, china is earthenware at its base, and earthenware like stoneware does not have to be tovel. But because there is a glass glaze on china, so some posts can treat it like glass, so china were tovel without a bracha. So I'll give you a whole share in this, but the one thing I want to mention is something that may be very, very relevant to you, and that is, if there is a chiyuv to be tovel these kelim before you eat with them or cook with them, so what is the halacha if I'm at my parents, and my parents are Jewish, and they, you know, and we arrange that all the food is kosher. Let's assume all the food is kosher, but nebuch, you know, they weren't tovel the kelim. Am I allowed to eat from those dishes and those forks and those knives if they were not toveled? Or do I have to have only plastic and the like? Toveling, is it a halacha? Absolutely. It's a Torah commandment. It's not just a halacha. It's a Torah commandment. So here, I just want to tell you that the Ramah rules for Ashkenazim that until a kli is toveled, you're not allowed to use it for eating. However, this is a very important thing to know, many achronim say that the Ramah's rule is only like a punishment for the person who owns the vessel, meaning if I own a pot or a pan, I'm not allowed to use it until I'm tovel. But vis-a-vis a guest or a child, you don't have that responsibility, and therefore we do paskin that you are allowed to eat on the dishes, the china, the cutlery, assuming it's kosher. Again, if it was used with non-kosher food, that's a whole other question, but assuming that it was not used with non-kosher food, you are permitted to eat food that was prepared in those pots, in those pans. You can eat it with the fork and the knife, because the understanding is that the Ramah's halacha is only directed to the person who owns it, and not to the person who doesn't own it. Now, an interesting thing is this, a very interesting idea is this. The chiyuv to be tovel is only when a Jew acquires it from a non-Jew. Mm-hmm. As long as it belongs to the non-Jew, mamash, there actually is no problem. So this is actually a heter that people give sometimes. Let's say, you know, I'm stranded. I'm in a hotel in China. Okay? And I bought a new pot. Okay? Because I have to cook. I'm in China. But I'm not allowed to use that pot until I'm tovel it in the mikveh. Because the Ramah's din is going to apply to me. So what do I do? So one of the things, you sell the pot to a non-Jew and then you borrow it from him. And as long as it belongs to the non-Jew, there is not yet an obligation of tevilah. Tevilah kicks in when there's a transfer from non-Jew to Jew. As long as it belongs to the non-Jew, there is no problem. Okay, so that is actually an eitzah that we sometimes give to people to take away the obligation of tevilah, where it's not possible for them to be tovel. Okay, but be it as it may, I guess I gave you a bit of good news, at least. Actually, probably you didn't have the problem until I mentioned it, but the bit of good news is, so I gave you a problem, then I told you it's not a problem. And that is, although it would be a mitzvah if you could help your parents be mekayim, tefilas kalim, that would be a very good thing, but it does not affect your kashrus laws, meaning to say, it does not make the food treif, and you don't have the obligation per se, and it's only your parents' obligation, so if they don't do it, they don't do it, but it does not stop you from eating the food. Same thing with hotels. You know, unfortunately, there are kosher hotels that sometimes did not properly immerse all of their pots and pans, but once again, it's not your problem, essentially. So it does not make the food treif. It's not like a non-kosher... See, in other words, a non-toveled pot is not like a treif pot. If it would be a treif pot, like they cook non-kosher food, you would have a big problem. But a pot that's not toveled is not a treif pot. So the food that's cooked is kosher, and you're allowed to eat that food. It's just the owner has an obligation to be toveled, but that's the owner's responsibility. That is not your responsibility.
What if there is
no
mikveh around you, and like no body of water, that kind of stuff?
Well, that's where I say you can give it to a guy, as it were. But you do have to find a valid mikveh if you're going to keep ownership. Now, there's an interesting question. I'll leave with one final question, then we'll break. The interesting question is, what do you do when you buy these electrical appliances that say you're not supposed to immerse them in water, or they get all messed up? Such as a toaster.
You do it anyway.
Right? Am I tovel a toaster? Am I tovel a... Actually, a toaster oven is very easy, because the only part you have to be tovel is the trays in which you put the bread. So a toaster oven, I don't have to put the whole toaster oven in. I just take out those trays, put them in. Same thing with a food processor. With a food processor, you take out the blades that cut the food, and you're tovel the blades and then put them back. So that's not a problem. But the two things where you do have a problem is your urns, like tea urns, and the other is coffee makers, would be the same thing, those fancy coffee makers, and the third would be a toaster. They would be examples of things where immersion in water could damage the circuitry. So what do you do with those situations? So the answer is, as you might suspect, there's much machlokas. There are many, many shitos. Some shitos say, grin and bear it. Immerse it, and just be sure you don't use it for at least 72 hours. Because the problem is going to be, if you use it and it's still wet inside, it'll short circuit and explode. You're not going to be very happy with that. You may lose your house, too. But the truth of the matter is, if you thoroughly let it dry out, maybe even a week would be best, it'll be okay usually. Very rarely does it get destroyed. That's one shita. But there's another shita that Moshe Feinstein has here, that you don't have to be tayvel these things at all. And the reason he gives is very interesting. He says that toasters, what do toasters do? You toast bread. Since the bread is edible even before you toast it, I don't consider this as part of a necessary cooking process. Meaning, any kli, which is simply improving a food, but it's not making the food edible, the food is already edible, does not require tevila. So that would apply also for tea and coffee makers, because the water, you know, is drinkable as water. So that's a leniency that some people rely upon, but it actually is better to be tovel them if you have them. Now, here though, we have a heter. Let's say you're afraid to be tovel them, so what do? So you either give it to a guy and borrow it, that old heter, or there's another heter for those who are mechanically gifted. And that is, what, are you mechanically gifted? So, yeah. So here's how it works. Here's how it works. If you can take it apart and reassemble it, so it is not a kli that you bought from a guy, it's a kli that you made, because you essentially broke it and then recreated it. So it doesn't have to be tayveled, because the only thing that has to be tayveled is a utensil that you bought from a guy, But here, you were mevatel, you destroyed it as a utensil, and you remade it. So if you are adept in that way, that would exempt you from tefillah. Okay, so these are just some things to think about, but we'll talk about this more after the holiday. All right, anyway, I want to wish you all a wonderful Chag Kosher V'Samech, wonderful Yom Tov, and may it be a true Zman of Yeshua and Geula for all of Klal Yisrael. Okay, thank you.